In northern Lithuania, there's a town I visited with Torah Traga maybe 10 years ago called Plungin. We had a rabbi then, Rabbi Nissel, that had a lot of jokes to say about the name of the town, Plungin. And one time, the rabbi of the community, he was trying to raise money for Kimcha de Pischa, to money for the poor, that the poor should have matzahs, should have meals, should have wine for the starim, for Pesach. And the people weren't giving, and they said, we don't have so much money. The Jewish people were very poor back then, and he wasn't able to collect anywhere close to the amount of money that they needed. So he got up in shul, the rabbi of the community, and said, I want to tell you, and Dvar Torah. And he quoted a pasuk from Parshas Ki Tetzé, where the Torah is telling us what's the reason why there's an added is in the Torah that Ammon and Moab can't enter the Jewish people, they can't convert and marry in and join the Jewish people until 10 generations later. It says, Lo yavo Ammoni Moavi b'kal Hashem, gam dor Asiri lo yavo lehem b'kal Hashem ad olam. That they're not able to enter the Jewish people. What's the reason? And the Torah goes on and tells us that when Bnei Yisrael were leaving Mitzrayim, and they didn't have food with them, and they were going out with millions of people into a desert, an entire nation, so Ammon and Moab, who could have came out and greeted them, and served them bread, and brought them water to help out this poor nation, they didn't go out and bring them their needs. Al dvar shelo kidmu etchem balechem ubamayim, baderech betzeitchem Mitzrayim. On the fact that they didn't come out and give them bread and water. But then the pasuk continues and says something else. And there's another reason why Ammon and Moab can't join the Jewish people. V'asher sachar alecha et Bilam ben Ba'or mipator aram narayim lekalalecha. And on the fact that they rented and they paid Bilam to go and curse the Jewish people to try to get the Jewish people destroyed. Why do we need that added reason? And what's the connection between that reason and the first reason? Asked the Rebbe of the community. And he answered, he said to them the following. Ammon and Moab could have given a fair excuse. We don't have enough money to support an entire nation, giving them bread and water. To go out and feed an entire nation of millions of people, that you expected from us? And maybe that would have been a fair and okay excuse on their part, and they still would have been able to enter the Jewish people. But then when we see that they spend tons of money that Bilam charged them for to curse the Jewish people, oh, you can't say you didn't have money. You had money to curse the Jewish people, and you didn't. So where was that money? You could have used that money to bring them bread and water when they were in the desert. Actions that they had done later on reflected what was the real intentions and the real meaning behind earlier actions. It wasn't because they didn't have money to give the Jewish people bread and water. Even if consciously they may have even said that in their head, that, you know, we can't really give them, we don't have enough money. But when push came to shove, we see, no, something's important to you, when you really want it, then you do have the money for it. And the Rav said, last week, you had a lot of money that you spent to bring in a Reform rabbi to speak here to all of you. So if you didn't really have money, then you wouldn't have had money to bring in that Reform rabbi. We see that you do have the money when push comes to shove. Sometimes people think that, and they legitimately believe themselves with the excuses that they give, that this is too hard for me, I don't have the money for it. But really, when we look at it in relation to other decisions that we make, it's reflective and shows that no, just because it wasn't important enough to you, and something that when it's more important, obviously you do have the money for it, or you do have the energy for it, or the strength for it. There's a famous story about Rav Shlomo Shvadron that he once went to a rally against Chilul Shabbos in Yerushalayim. He was part of a bunch of protesters in Yerushalayim. They were protesting against Chilul Shabbos happening in the streets of Yerushalayim, and he was one of the speakers at that protest. And a lot of his followers were upset. Why are you making it your business? Why are you dealing with this? Why are you going out and protesting? No one's going to listen to you anyway. Why are you making so much noise? It's a Chil Hashem. He didn't respond. But a couple of weeks later, there was another rally in Yerushalayim where people were going out and fighting and protesting against the fact that they were raising taxes, municipality taxes in Yerushalayim. People went out and they were screaming and shouting and protesting. And that he didn't go to, but some of the people that followed him that had claims on him a few weeks earlier, they did go to it. So he got up that week in shul, and he told him the following story. I think Rabbi Steinman might have told us this year or last year. This is the Merkah story. So when Shalom Chadron, one time he was watching his grandchildren in the park. They were playing with one of their friends, Meir, and during the course of their playing, Meir fell down, banged his head, and started bleeding from his head. Probably, it didn't end up being a crazy, dangerous situation, but there was a lot of blood. The head bleeds a lot. And Roshan Chadron picked him up and started to run towards the local doctor. And he's concerned, and he's rushing. And there was an old lady looking from the window a block or two away that saw Roshan Chadron getting very nervous and rushing with this child. And she didn't know yet at the time that this was her own grandchild. So she didn't know yet. She started saying, "No, don't worry. Hashem's going to help. Relax. Don't worry. You can walk. Calm down." And as he was getting closer, and she started to realize that it was her own grandson, she started screaming, "Mayor, America, America!" And she started screaming and running down to the street and seeing what she could do to help. And all of a sudden, she became frantic. So Shon Chadron turned to the audience and he said, "Everybody has their America. Over your America, you're going to get nervous. You're going to get frantic. You're going to get worried. The difference is, what's your America? My America is Chilul Shabbos. That's what makes me nervous. That's what makes me want to protest. That's what makes me upset. Your America is money, having to pay more taxes. That's what pulls you out into the streets to protest. But it's a matter of when something really matters to you, that's how you react." There's two stories in Sefer Shoftim that are seemingly unrelated, but the Gemara shows that they're very related. One story is the story of Micha. Micha, we know, is that baby, one of the babies that was stuffed in the wall in Egypt when Moshe Rabbeinu turned to Hashem and he said, "How could you do this, Rosh HaVetov Lo Tzadik V'Ra'alo? How could you have babies crushed in the wall?" So Hashem let him choose one baby to take out of the wall. He took out Micha. He said, "Watch what happens to this baby as he grows older." This Micha was the one that was very instrumental in making Chayta Egel. This Micha was the one that had a pesel set up in an area in Eretz Yisrael where he would bring in a lot of Achnasas Orchim, bring people in, give them food and water, and then ask them to worship the Avodah Zarah that he had in his house, the pesel Micha. It was a very popular place for passerbyers to stop by, eat, and worship the Avodah Zarah that he had over there. That's one story in Shoftim. A few prakim later, it talks about Pilegesh Begiva, where there was a few men from Shevet Binyamin that raped somebody's Pilegesh to the point that they killed her. First time that something that horrible and tragic happened in Klai Yisrael, to the point that when the tribe of Binyamin wouldn't give those people over, it wouldn't hand them over to be punished, so all the tribes of Israel went to war against Shevet Binyamin. They even asked the Urim V'Tumim who should go first, and Hashem seemed to show that he was very behind them going to war against Shevet Binyamin. But in that war, tens of thousands of Jews were killed on both sides, also on the side of those that were fighting the right cause. And it's confusing, because if they're fighting the right cause, why all of a sudden we have tens of thousands of Jews dying? So those two stories, Pesel Micha and Pilegesh Begiva, don't seem to be related at all. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Parachelek shows how they're very related. And the Gemara has the following discussion. It says, how come Micha isn't in the list of those Jews that lose their chelek in Olam Haba? Apparently Micha ended up, after however long and however bad the punishments that he had to go through in Shemaim were, but eventually he was going to get Olam Haba. He didn't lose his chelek in Olam Haba. And the Mishnah and Parachelik lists those that have a chelek, that lost their chelek, and he's not in that list. So why does Micha, he caused tens of thousands of Jews to serve Avodah Zarah, why did he have a chelek in Olam Haba? So the Gemara answers, because he was so machnas orchim that he gave bread and water and put people up in his house, that for that, he deserves Olam Haba. The Gemara then continues and asks, why is it that in the story of Pilegesh Begiva, so many people were killed, so many Jews died in that battle? And then the Gemara tells the following. At the time of Pesel Micha, the smoke over his home from the korbanos that were brought to worship the Avodah Zarah, there was so much smoke that it spread and reached all the way and mixed with the smoke that was coming up over the Mishkan from the Mizbeach over there, and the two smokes mixed together, and that was a terrible Chil Hashem. That the smoke that's going up for the Korbanos Hashem is mixing with smoke going up to an Avodah Zarah. That's how many people were worshipping Avodah Zarah. So Hashem says, "Bekvodi lo machitem, bekvod basar v'dam machitem." When it came to my honor, the smoke of Pesach Micha mixing with the smoke over the Mishkan, nobody protested, nobody went to battle, nobody asked the Urim V'Tumim who should fight first, who should go first. That you were able to live with, that you were able to stand on the side and be okay with and accept. But when it came to what was done to this woman, because it's a Ben Adam Lechavero, and it hurts your heart to see what was done to this poor lady, and they're right for their hearts being hurt, but then you wanted to go to war, then you wanted to go to battle, then you made a huge protest. So, Bekvod Dilo Mechitem, for my honor, you never protested. Bekvod Basav Adam, for the honor of flesh and blood, that you are going to protest. So, even though they were going out for the right cause, but this now showed that when something really bothers you, then you go to war and you go to battle. And this showed that it didn't really bother you, the Pesach Micha. Now, all of Klai Yisrael was held accountable for that, and that's why so many people died in the battle. The battle itself was for the right reasons, but it was reflective of where their real values and where their real priorities were. I made this point in a small way to Rabbi Zinkenshir a week or two ago, but I wanted to say to everybody, I was going around the last 2 weeks asking guys, you know, would you like to spend the day with Levi Greenspan? I don't think anyone hesitated for a second. Everyone said, yes, yes, I want. People came to me, I didn't get a chance to. It's not fair. He favors him. I want to get to go. Sign me up. I explained to him, what do you need to do? Well, you probably have to wake up about 6:45 in the morning, get on a 7:10 bus. You want to take a cab, get in a cab by 7:20, 7:25, take your tefillin with you. No one hesitated. Nobody's like, no one even said, really, that early? Not even hesitate. Okay, great, for sure. No, but Drich woke them up. Somehow they were able to wake up to their alarm on those mornings. No complaints, complete excitement. If I would ask them to do it another day, they for sure would have agreed. Everyone asked, can I have another time with him? Why can't we say the same thing over here? B'kvod ilam machitem, b'kvod basav adam machitem. That for the honor of a human being to take care of someone who's blind, that you're rushing, that you're excited, that you're happy, that great, beautiful, that's coming from a beautiful, beautiful, good, good place. But for a Kadosh Baruch Hu, not. Then all of a sudden the alarm doesn't wake us up, and it's hard even with the Madrich, or some days we make Minyan, some days we won't make Minyan. Imagine having to wake up to a Minyan at 10 to 7 in the morning. That's just, I'm not capable, Rabbi. That my body's not able to do that. And then, if let's say we have a trip one morning to go to Eilat, or we're going to stay up for the Super Bowl, all of a sudden somebody has all the energy in the world to stay up an entire night and not be falling asleep in the middle of the game. So these reflections show, these situations show and reflect on ourselves, that when something really matters to us, when something's very important to us, then all of a sudden we have different capabilities and different things that we are willing to do. And we are willing to push ourselves. And therefore, we should never buy our own excuses of what we're able to do and not what we're not able to do. We're able to do a lot more than what we think. It's a matter of what you want to do and what your values are. A person's values, this is something to remember, a person's values are not what they say their values are and not what they think their values are. A person's values are what they show their values to be. You want to know what your values are, look at what you do, and that shows where you're holding in terms of your values. If you're checking somebody out to marry one day, don't ask, oh, what would you do in this situation, or what do you think about that, or what do you believe about that, or whatever speech she gives to you. Watch her decisions, and watch what she does, and that's how you know what their real priorities are, what their real values are. And when you want to learn about yourself, it's not enough that on a multiple choice question test, you say, okay, Torah Hashem comes first, and then this comes second, this comes third. No. If you want to know what comes first, second, and third by you, look at how you make decisions. What you're willing to wake up for, what you're willing to spend a lot of time on, what you're willing to stay up late for, what you're willing to fight your parents for, what you're willing to not fight for, what matters to you a lot. That's when you want to see where your values are really holding. No one, I don't think anyone has ever holding an action by what they think in their head. That's our job all the time, is to have our actions match up more and more and more with the beliefs that we have in our head. You know things in your head, but now you need to be v'ashevot elavecha, bring them to your heart. We're a human being by nature is not going to be holding in their actions by what they believe in their head. It's work and it's effort, and that's where the Yetzirah gets us. But we have to be honest with where it is that we're holding in order that we can move up. A problem that people often do is that we don't like to feel cognitive dissonance. We don't like to feel not good about ourselves. We want to feel successful. We want to feel that we're good. So when we notice that my actions don't fit with the things that I believe in, so a mature person is going to then say, okay, I need to have my actions fit more with the things that I believe in. And an immature person is going to start changing the things they believe in order to match their actions, that they could feel good about themselves and not have to inconvenience themselves to make any changes or any adjustments. And that's a destruction. So what we have to work on, and the challenge is that as we see that we're not succeeding at something that we believe in, not to let belief change in the smallest, but to take responsibility and figure out, what could I do? What are the changes that I could make to help match more the things that I believe in? Yeah, I'll throw in one more thing. This is risky, but when a person comes to Shemayim, there's this topic that people like to talk about. Happens to be, in Torah Traga, used to be a really hot topic for like 10, 12 years. The last couple of years, I don't even think it's such a hot topic. If you want to know why I don't think it's a hot topic, you can ask me later what my thoughts on that are. But it used to be a big topic, talk about a person's hashkafa. What's your hashkafa? Are you part of this world? Are you part of that world? Are you going to live in that community or that community? It's less of a hot topic nowadays, but it's still there. It's still something that people think about. When a person comes to Shemayim, there's never a stage, and nowhere in Chazal, and nowhere, there's not going to be a part where you come to Shemayim and they ask you, what did you wear, as long as it's halachically okay? What was your hashkafa? What community did you associate yourself with? Something that's not explicit halachos in the Shulchan Aruch, or in the Gemara, they're not going to be asking you those questions. They're going to be asking you, to what extent did you keep the Shulchan Aruch? So it's not like, oh, because I'm this hashkaf or I'm this community, all these things are now mutter for me. There's no such thing like that. The Shulchan Aruch, it completely applies to everybody 100%. One of the excuses that we've developed, the reason why people like this concept of hashkaf is because no longer do we have to answer to the demands of the Shulchan Aruch, now we just have to fit into our hashkafa. And that becomes our book of priorities, our book of values. But sometimes we have to be careful that it's not just an excuse to not have to make any adjustments or changes, or not to inconvenience ourselves. And a person has to hold himself next to the ultimate perfect truth, what the Torah expects from us. And when we notice that there's big discrepancies between us and what's expected of us, not to change and start saying, okay, so not the Shulchan Aruch, instead my hashkafa, my community, but no, to start working on ourselves, to match up to what the Torah expects of us. It's gaiva for a person to think that they're going to be perfect or that they don't need to change anything. And it's completely normal and human to recognize that I'm not holding by perfection. I'm nowhere close to what the Torah wants of me. But I'm going to take one small step after another small step, like Rabbi Ifra likes to say, la'at, la'at, and we're going to slowly go to, and that's what Hashem wants from us. He doesn't want perfect people. He wants people that are always going in the path to become better and to come closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shubi Zohar. We have Mishmar now upstairs in the classroom.
Why do you think...